Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Interns are everywhere now, paid and unpaid. More than ever, an internship, or two or three or more, is seen as key to landing a job eventually, maybe someday, in big segments of the workplace. Does this make sense? Is it a mutually beneficial arrangement or just exploitation? And does it grow the divide between haves and have-nots if to get a job you have to be able to work for nothing? This hour on Point, the internship economy, how it works or doesn't, and where it's headed. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you in an internship right now? Paid? Unpaid? Does it feel like a good investment? Does it feel exploitative? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, our last commencement address excerpt of the season, actor and comedian Ed Helms speaks to Knox College graduates in Illinois. But first, the internship economy. It's in theaters right now. The new movie, The Internship, you've got Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson playing characters who have bagged internships at Google, or they hope so anyway.
Vic, I got it.
Google.
You got us a job at Google?
Not a job. It's an interview for an internship that could lead to a job. Nick, this might be the last chance that we got.
Oh boy, it is in the popular culture, and it is very much in the workforce. With us right now from Washington, Ross Eisenbray, Vice President at the Economic Policy Institute, lawyer, former commissioner for the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. He's had his eye on this issue, the internship economy, for a long time. Ross Eisenbray, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hi. Thanks, Tom.
So this is not new. People have been getting and doing internships for a long time, but it's definitely grown. I mean, I never had an unpaid job in my life. I had plenty, you know, janitor and all the rest, but never unpaid. These days, that seems to be, for a certain part of the economy anyway, you tell us, seems to be the norm. What's the spread of this like, Ross?
Well, I never had an unpaid job either, and it used to be that entry-level work was minimum wage work. You got paid for it. You got paid a very low wage, but and then eventually you worked your way up, and employers didn't pretend that you were supposed to come with skills and experience to your entry-level job. Something happened over the last 20 or 30 years, and employers, I think part of it is that the government shrank in the Reagan administration, and law enforcement in the labor area shrank dramatically by about, it was cut in half. And so employers found that they could get away with calling somebody an intern, even though it was just a typical entry-level job. And so now we've gotten to the point where there are probably, in any given year, 500,000 young people, mostly young people, but not entirely, working unpaid in jobs that should be paid under the Fair Labor Standards Act, should be paid at least the minimum wage. And there are jobs that I see advertisements in Craigslist and other places for unpaid internships that require people to have had prior experience, to come with skills in computers and database management. It's pretty shocking.
I do remember the first time I was thinking about this was back when these were kind of glamour jobs. Like somebody might get a job at a glossy magazine in New York, and it might be unpaid. This is way back. But it's moved way beyond that kind of glossy part of the economy. I mean, what sectors has this intern phenom moved into now? How deep, how wide in the economy, Ross?
Well, we see retail companies, manufacturing companies advertising for unpaid interns. Certainly, I don't know how glamorous journalism is anymore, but it's widespread in journalism, the film industry, TV, the fashion industry. Apparently, employers there think it's their right to hire their first to hire people for their first two or three jobs and not have to pay them.
Is there evidence that interning is leading people, putting people on a path to paying jobs, to make a living, to live?
You know, it's very mixed. I think we're to the point where there are employers who say that they want to see experience on a resume before they'll hire somebody for what is an entry-level job. So that employer, for that employer, maybe the only way in is through an internship. And presumably most of those internships now are going to be unpaid. But there's also evidence that this is a way to hurt yourself, for a young person to hurt him or herself.
How?
The National Association of Colleges and Employers surveyed young people who had had internships and found if you had a paid internship, you were more likely to get hired and more likely to find a job that paid a good wage. If you were in an unpaid internship, you did worse than, in some instances, than people who had no internship at all.
Now, why would that be? Because a prospective employer says, this person is willing and prepared and able to work for free, so let's do that again?
Yeah, you've shown that you are a vulnerable person in the workforce, willing to work for nothing. And so an employer, instead of offering you, let's say they offer you a job, instead of offering you $35,000, they know they can get you for $25,000. So I think that this is real evidence that you can hurt yourself by taking these unpaid internships.
Are there statistics on what percentage of internships are unpaid? I mean, we hear about these jazzy ones, Google software interns making like $6,000, $6,500 a month. That must sound great to a lot of young people. But do we know what percentage are paid and what percentage unpaid?
You know, I only have a sense of this from paying a lot of attention to it, reading. There are services who have been following this for many years. NACE is one. Vault is another. It's a company that does surveys and has been tracking internships for a couple of decades. My sense is that about half or more are unpaid now, and that mostly it's women. And I've seen a lot of writing about this lately.
What, more women than men taking internships, you're saying?
Maybe two-thirds or three-quarters of the unpaid interns are women.
Now, why would that be?
Well, they generally fare worse in the labor market than men. You know, there is still gender discrimination, and women make about 79 cents to the dollar that men make on average. Women are, you know, they have, unfortunately, probably self-esteem problems, and they also are tending to go into industries like fashion where this is more frequent.
Self-esteem issues. On the other hand, you know, some of these internships, people see themselves as real hotshots if they get them. Part of what's talked about here as well is, you know, who can do this and who can't. I mean, if you've got a family that can support you, or you've got somehow some money in the bank, you can have a place to live and money to buy food while you do an internship. If you don't, you can't. In some ways, this puts a wedge between the haves and have-nots again, Ross.
It does, and I think it's a growing problem because this whole phenomenon is growing. But it's a particular problem with government because there it's not illegal, and we should talk about that. That a lot of these are illegal employment relationships that are masquerading as internships. But in the government, that they actually have the right to hire somebody and not pay them, to take volunteer service. And when that is your only foot in the door to get a job, let's say as a legislative aide in Congress, that you have to go through this path that starts with unpaid internships and sometimes serial unpaid internships, two or three of them, who can afford to do that? It's upper middle class kids and working class and middle class families can't afford to send their children to Washington and pay the rents here and have their child work for nothing.
We'll look at the law and we'll look at the hiring and employment and all the rest. We'll talk with a career counselor out of college in just a minute. Let me get a caller in here before the break. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see? What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm 54. Internships are for rich kids, Tom. They always have been, and I think your guest is right on point, so to speak.
Yep.
that this really needs to be cracked down on, because it's an unfair advantage. If we're required to have these kind of things for employment in the future, then it's an unfair advantage. I mean, I took an internship. I rode a Harley all when I was younger, and I was working as a stringer, photojournalist.
Yeah. Okay.
And trying to make it in the commercial photography field. I remember a big shoot came up for Harley Davidson, my dream shoot, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it was going to be a three-month gig. I couldn't afford to take it. I was on ramen noodles, but somebody, a kid who is, I believe his parents were from India, is very wealthy, decided he could take it and went off. And I remember asking him, I said, do you even care about Harleys? He's like, no, I don't care at all. He says, this is just a gig for me. And I see that all the time. I just had, where I work now, we just had an intern through, and I asked him, I said, how are you paying for this? And he goes, oh, well, it's my parents. Now, this is a very, very, this was a very, very coveted position.
Yeah.
And the only people that can afford that are wealthy kids. So,
Dave, we got it. The break is coming up right here. I've got to let you go with that, but we've got it. 3 months, no pay. You couldn't do it. Somebody else did. It's on their resume. It's not on yours. And we are in right there, the internship economy. We're going to look at that dynamic and much more in this hour. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the internship economy, who it helps, who it hurts, and where it takes us. If you can get a great one, great for you. Google pays really nice if you get an internship there. That's the gimmick at the heart of the new movie that's out with Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn, The Internship. Here's Google's real-world recruiting director, Adam Ward, telling Fox News last week that well-qualified interns are competed over by many companies in Silicon Valley.
They negotiate. They have their pick of really where they want to work, what products, what country. So it's very competitive for internships, and we work really hard. We put as much effort into hiring interns as we do new grads.
Hey, good luck and good for you if you can get one of those. Of course, they're not all that way. Some pay, many do not. Lots of questions here. Do internships really put you on the job ladder? Ross Eisenbray is with us from the Economic Policy Institute. He's been paying a lot of attention to this. Also with us right now from Williamsburg, Virginia, is Mary Schilling, Executive Director of Career Development at the College of William & Mary. It's a public research university in Williamsburg. Mary Schilling, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here, I mean, your job is to get your young students on the right path in education and on out into the career world. How important are internships in that process these days, Mary?
Well, I've been in the field long enough to know, Tom, that originally I would say that, you know, internships are the best kept secret for getting started in your career path. Then I started saying, you know, it's not even a secret. You got to do it. So we really try to encourage students to do at least one, if not a couple, of internships, whether in the local community during the academic year, during the summer in their home community or in other communities. It really does make a difference, not just in their employability, but their level of confidence, their ability to make a connection between what they're learning in the classroom and the academic experience and the real world. The application of sort of theory to practice becomes really important. And learning about the corporate culture or the nonprofit culture, the government sector, communication, all of these experiences really do make for a more employable, more confident, more job-ready individual.
Is there a hierarchy of internships, Mary? You know, the ones that are really sought after and the ones that are just sort of help you check the box. What about it?
You know, I think it's less a hierarchy, although there are hierarchies within these sectors, but I think the issue is sectors. If you're talking about the corporate sector, you're talking about finance, accounting, consulting, technology, engineering, those kinds of firms usually pay because they have that ability to pay, and they can be competitive with a paid internship. But then you have communication like PR, advertising, communication, publishing, those kinds of groups who do not pay But what they often do is say, since we're not going to pay you, we are willing to have you do this internship only if you take academic credit. So that sort of relieves them of the pressure, I think, or the expectation to pay. And many students want these experiences in the communication industry enough that they will do them for academic credit, and they get that support from the college. And then there are those in the nonprofit sector, environmental, the arts, et cetera, who really don't usually have the kind of staffing budget to be able to pay an intern. But the students, again, need that experience to break into the field.
Well, maybe you can't get a job without it then in some arenas, but can you get a job with it? Are these really putting kids on a job ladder, or, you know, do you see people going from internship to internship to internship? Pretty soon you're 20, who knows how many years old?
No, I would say that, of course, the having an internship or two in the resume helps. It helps you to convey your skill sets in an interview. It helps you in networking with other people, you know, knowing about LinkedIn and using that as a part of your whole preparation for that first job are really important. And if you have that internship experience as a kind of a base, it's extremely helpful.
Ross, take us back to the law. What is the law here? Then, Mary, we'll come to you and ask if people are following it. But what's the law when it comes to internships and what they do and pay, Ross?
Well, it's very unlikely that you can have a legal internship in PR, in advertising, in publishing. These are all for-profit businesses that are covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act, which says you cannot suffer or permit an employee to work for you and not pay the minimum wage. So when these are unpaid internships, the chances are you know, close to 100% that it's an illegal relationship. And there's a six-part test that the Department of Labor has online. It's a guidance document, fact sheet number 71, that anybody can find online. And it says that the internship has to be structured, closely supervised, like a, you know, like vocational education. It has to be for the benefit of the student, not for the benefit of the PR company or advertising company that's getting this work. There can't be an immediate benefit to them. The idea being they ought to be putting more into educating the student than they're getting out in work product.
Okay.
It can't displace another employee. So, you know, every company has somebody who answers the phones. If the internship is answering the phones, you're replacing somebody, you know, that's a job that should be paid.
Right, okay.
So those are four of the six. Then, I mean, you can't be promised that at the end of this unpaid experience, you'll be given a job. That's another.
Why not? People would probably love that promise.
Well, then it's just like try out employment. The employer is just getting a period of free service, and it's planning to hire you anyway. So the idea here is to protect the labor market and to make sure we're close to the 75th anniversary, in fact, of the Fair Labor Standards Act that created the minimum wage. And the idea was people were underpaid. We had a nation that didn't have the ability to consume in the Great Depression, because they were, you know, the people were making 13, 15 cents an hour.
Yeah.
So the minimum wage says, no, you have to be paid at least this minimal amount, $7.25 an hour. And any employer that's getting the benefit of your work is obligated to pay it.
Let me take that to Mary, if I may. Mary, you're listening to that checklist of sort of what makes it legal or illegal. What's your guess? I'm putting you on the spot here, but of the people from, you know, William and Mary who go out into the intern world, what percentage do you think end up in a legal internship situation in terms of those terms being actually met?
Yeah, I'm not going to suggest a percentage, Tom, but I'm going to say that we're aware of those six criteria. We help students to understand those. We have students talk about internship responsibilities, functions, and make that a part of the decision as to whether or not to take an internship. I'd be curious to know from Ross, if a student is getting academic credit for the experience in a position that is otherwise unpaid, does that take care of the issue, since it's closely related to the academic curriculum? It's building skills. It's highly supervised. There's a culminating project that's evaluated, et cetera. Does that take the place of, and does that make it less of a problem?
It does possibly, if it really is closely supervised, if it's structured and followed by a professor, and it's possible that it could be. On the other hand, the student is actually paying for the tuition and the credit. You know, the financial flow is still all in the wrong direction from the student to the university. That's fine. You know, if they're getting something and something educational from it, but with respect to the employer still isn't paying anything for that student's work. And so it's still problematic. I think the Department of Labor hasn't brought a case to clarify how it feels about this. But I think Northeastern University for years had something. It wasn't called internships. It was like a sort of a work study.
Yeah,
the co-op.
Mm-hmm. Co-op, right? That kind of closely structured situation definitely qualifies as exempt from the minimum wage. But the farther you get away from that, really intense interaction between the school and the student in the work environment, the harder it is for that to escape the obligation to pay.
We've got all kinds of reaction online here, positive and negative and in between. Somebody's saying, back in the 19th century, even kids in the coal mine got paid something. It wasn't much, but it was something. Let me bring our listeners in. Allie's calling from Boston. Hi, Allie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I actually just graduated from Northeastern in May.
Great. Congratulations.
I did about five different internships and co-ops in my 4 years there. And one of them last summer was unpaid. It started out unpaid. I'm a journalism major.
Okay.
But they ended up, coming up with money for me. But, Ross was totally right. I had to pay about $1,000 to work for free all summer on top of, finding a car. And it was kind of a stretch. But, I think it definitely paid off. I had the experience that I didn't really have in my paid positions. And, I think that it was useful, but would I have liked to be paid full-time? Yes, that would have been great.
And what about your peers, others who graduating with you who have done internships? It's a little different from doing that co-op or work study, I guess, but do they generally look positive on it, or do they feel like exploited labor? How do you look at it, Allie?
For those that can afford to go, 6 months or 2 months or whatever the time period is unpaid, it's great for them, but, it wasn't something I could ever swing. I think that some of them did get hired after their position. Some of them didn't, but ended up getting, opening a door to a new job that was more competitive and did, have a paid co-op or paid internship.
Right. So if it works, it can get you up on the tracks, up on the rails, and into a career. Allie, I hope that works out well for you. I appreciate your call. Mary Ross, here's Tom, says there's nothing wrong with internships. They can be great and have their place. That's not the point. The question is their use soaring way beyond what was normal, quote unquote, as a corporate cost-cutting tactic. Why pay for what you can get for free? Tom writes to us here, I expect some MBAs are asking, why didn't we think of that before? It's even better than Bangladesh.
Yeah.
I don't know, Ross, what do you say?
Well, I first got interested in this because at the start of the recession, way back in like 2008, I saw stories about people who were 35, 36 years old, mid-career people who were being called interns by employers. They were designing websites for them, doing skilled work that definitely should have been paid for, but they were called interns and not paid. And I said, what is that? And you can see how this, it starts small with students who are doing something in the summer or during the school year, and then pretty soon you have hundreds of thousands of students graduating with college degrees and going to what used to be paid work and not being paid for it. And it's a drag on the economy. It's a very dangerous, slippery slope. And that follows them. If your first year of working or 6 months is unpaid, then you've started, you know, behind on the whole curve for the rest of your life and your in your work career.
I mean, that's one way to look at it. Another of the case, of course, that would be made is you've got a leg up, you've got a foot in, you've learned something. Let me go to Rick calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a father of four, one of which is still in, one has graduated from college and two are still in college. And maybe the process that your two guests described is true of the elite students in the elite schools. But when you get to average students in public schools, the major in the career counseling is barely adequate. They're told they need to get internships to find jobs. They're charged. They're not paid by the employers if they're able to scrounge one up. They pay tuition to a school who does nearly nothing and provides nearly no supervision of the experience. They're treated like indentured servants by half of the employers. So maybe these big corporations that are hiring MIT students or something or Northeastern students are treated well and they follow the six rules. But my experience for the average student is the schools give them virtually no guidance and structure and provide nearly no oversight of the employers, and the employers treat them like slaves and pay them nearly nothing.
Let me do a reality check with Mary. We got your impression of it, and you may be right, Rick, but Mary Schilling, you must be listening with burning ears to that. You're in the biz. What do you say?
Thanks. Well, one of the things that you need to know about me is, and William and Mary, is that we deal with primarily an 18 to 22-year undergraduate student body, and that is probably different from a lot of the public institutions that you might be thinking of.
Well, isn't that the normal college age, 18
exactly.
to 22?
Exactly, okay. But some references have been made to, you know, older interns or to
let's just stick
schools
with that,
that
age,
don't
though.
Provide
that,
the
that's kind
of
yeah.
Sure. So the expectation of the career center on whoever's campus we're talking about is that they make it clear to students what these opportunities are, what the issues are, what kinds of expectations are realistic, what they can bring to the table, what they can expect to get out of an internship. We can't obviously supervise every single internship unless it's one that we've developed, but it is true that we can help students to manage and negotiate the situations that they are in to try to get the best learning experience possible, to connect it to their academic trajectory, and to use it as a way of really building and honing skills that are going to be used once they do the job search for their first job out of college. So it seems to me that there are a lot of career professionals across the country who seek to make that internship experience really productive. In fact, what we're seeing is that more and more employers are not coming to campus in just the fall to interview seniors. They're starting early identification programs, even at the freshman and sophomore year.
Interns
who will one day be potential employees, because what they want to do is identify students, help students to make the kinds of choices that will really enrich and enhance their college experience, whether it's encouraging leadership, encouraging volunteer service, study abroad, foreign language, computer skills, so that by the time they are ready for their first job, they put together a pretty solid package, and one of the components would be an internship.
If you're tough on these companies coming with internships, if you really monitor whether they follow the letter of the law, do they come back? Or do they say, you know, William & Mary is tough to deal with, we'll just take a pass?
Well, I think, Tom, that the employers who are used to doing these internships, especially if they have a national program of internships or they're a regionally identified company, those are ones who usually pay their interns. We're talking about concern for those smaller groups, those startup companies, those nonprofit groups, government, et cetera, who really are not as adept at handling the whole internship development program.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the internship economy, who it helps, who it hurts, and where it takes us. Mary Schilling is with us, Executive Director of Career Development at the College of William & Mary, a public research university, Williamsburg, Virginia. Ross Eisenbray is here, Vice President at the Economic Policy Institute. He's paid a lot of attention to this. Lots of people writing in to us here. Catherine says, for 6 years, I placed college women in internships. Number of good-paying jobs resulting was huge. There's a thumbs up. Leg Nguyen says, this is America. You don't want to take an internship? Don't. You do? Then do. No one's forcing you to do free labor. Use the experience for experience or to get a job that pays. Choices, she writes, are fun. Callie says, it's exploitation and taking advantage of desperate students. There's the range right there. Let's go to Sybil in Atlanta, Georgia. Sybil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a graduate student in creative writing, and I think our university requires us to do two internships. So I have 25 years experience. I'm 51. I'm trying to get my graduate degree to do teaching, and I interviewed for two internships. One said, oh, you're so overqualified, but we're still just going to pay you $15 an hour. Tried to negotiate for more. It's like, no way. So I took the other job, which was a very nice company, very nice people, but I'm not learning anything, and I'm also paying tuition to the college. So I think at the graduate level, they definitely need to do something to give people credit for what they've already done in their life experience instead of charging us tuition.
Let me understand. You're 51 years old. Are you an intern, or are you a student teacher?
I am currently an intern, and I'm currently a graduate student. I'm taking a full load at the Savannah College of Art and Design, which has a campus in Atlanta.
And they require these internships of you to graduate?
Two internships. Two field internships, or one teaching internship, which is generally going to be unpaid, and one field internship.
Is this the same as student-teacher duty, which we've known about for years, Sybil? Are you just not liking the student-teacher challenge, or is it something different from it?
I am doing a field internship. So yeah. I'm actually working in the field of architecture, which is where I came from, in marketing. And I'm working with a great company, and they're wonderful people, but I'm not really learning anything. I'm doing exactly what I was doing at my very well-paid job in architecture marketing before I left to go back to school.
Yeah.
So I think there are some flaws there that really need to be examined. The university, their college is getting a lot of tuition. I'm not netting any money, let's put it that way.
Right, no, we've got it loud and clear. Yeah. Sybil, in Atlanta, I appreciate your call. Mary Schilling, what do you make of this? Is this common for colleges now to require this, no matter what the pay?
I think it's important when you enter a graduate program to really get clear on what the expectations are, what the requirements are, what the issues of pay or credit are. So obviously, you know, you want to do that. If you choose to do a graduate degree after you've already had significant experience, one would hope that you could get some, quote, credit or have some things waived because of that experience. But that's between the college or the graduate program and the student. That's not something that I think we can sort of legislate, because usually there are educational reasons for wanting to have all of your graduates have a kind of a standard level of experience, whether it's, you know, in the classroom or whether it's in an ad agency or an architectural firm or whatever. I wanted, Tom, to see if we could talk about the issue of leveling the playing field. Is that something that we could talk about briefly?
In what regard? What do you mean?
Well, if we say that certain students are disadvantaged, let's say if we feel as though a lot of the unpaid internships may be taken by students who are middle class, upper middle class, whatever, because they can afford to take an unpaid internship. One of the things that colleges and universities across the country are doing is to try to recognize the fact that first-generation students or students from certain socioeconomic levels may be truly disadvantaged because they feel like they have to make money and bring in some money for college or for spending money or whatever it is. So what a number of colleges have done is put together funding programs to which a student can apply. So a student would secure an internship, let's say it's in a nonprofit or a government or a environmental or whatever, propose a request, put in a kind of a proposal for $2,000 to $3,000 of money for the summer so they could afford to not work at flipping burgers or mowing lawns or painting houses, but could instead do a significant pre-professional educational and a real significant kind of internship and could be at least stipended for the summer. And that would be usually out of, you know, alumni monies, parent monies, some other kinds of sort of philanthropic, charitable kinds of contributions that would say, okay, look, we want students to not be disadvantaged by their background and to have the same opportunities that students of the upper middle class and upper class would be having.
So there are ways to level the playing field, but it doesn't mean that everybody has access to those ways.
The only access would be how much money there is and how many, you know, grants any particular university or college could make to student applicants. So it's not it's a kind of a band-aid. It helps a little bit.
Yep.
I think it's important to try to do whatever it is we can, but it is true that we have to be sure that our opportunities are on as level a playing field as we can construct.
Though it sounds like some charity, maybe, for those who aren't on that level playing field, and good luck to them in getting it. May in Newport News, Virginia, you're on the air, May.
Hi, Tom. I'm also a student at the College of William & Mary, so I'm familiar with how great the Career Center is with helping students out finding internships. My question is, so I know that a good amount of students who go to William & Mary are from affluent families where they are even getting internships at really great companies before they've even entered college. And
how do they do that, May?
That's my question. Like, I want to know your opinions on how these students, because they come from affluent families and their families have connections, while the college, the Career Center gives a ton of opportunities to the students who may not have such connections.
Yep.
But the students who are going to the Career Center, these are students, like I said, without the connections, there are going to be hundreds of students fighting for the same internship, while the students who are from affluent families, they don't even have competition. Because they are almost, for a lot of them, they have internships after their freshman year at places like Thomas Rutgers, I forgot the name.
But it's sort of a sweet spot to be in, and maybe because of connections. Ross, let me bring that to you, because that's another interesting dynamic here, where, I mean, we're all worried these days about equity in our country and in our economy. It has fallen. And pay is one issue, but even beyond pay, May's raising this issue of if you're in a certain class, in a certain set, you may have more access, a kind of red velvet access to the kind of positions that have become increasingly required for you to get on the job ladder. There's a sort of built-in them that's got get dynamic there.
Well, that will never go away, but you know, it's always been the case that if you're wealthy and from the elite, you have connections that others don't.
But when internships were less common and you were competing, whether you're actually going to give a job to somebody, they might compete on merit and take it a little more seriously about who they chose.
Yeah, although I think people still gave jobs to the children of friends in the old days. But we have proposed at EPI that the federal government, rather than having us rely on charity and the sort of hit or miss thing that Mary was talking about from that some universities do, have the federal government actually fund work by low-income or middle-income students in internships that they otherwise couldn't afford.
That would be great.
Like a work-study program that would fund this on a larger scale, on $500 million a year.
Of course, maybe a nice idea. It's not happening. Yar writes to us here online, says, we have internships for the poor. It is called military service. funny, but not, right? Comes with a special threat level. Nancy writes, says, my son feels lucky to have been chosen for an unpaid internship. However, that means his dad still pays his rent and utilities, and I buy his groceries and clothes. Difficult place for my son and for his parents. He is 27. That's a dynamic, Ross, that's tough for people.
Yeah. Well, let me just take a step back and talk about what's happening to college graduates overall, because I think this is playing into a dynamic that over in the long term is very dangerous. Entry-level wages for college graduates have fallen. Male college graduates are earning no more today than they did in 1973, and they and women college graduates are worse off than they were 13 years ago. They're earning less when they graduate from college. And I think the unpaid internship phenomenon is part of this. It's
because they're competing with people working for free? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. So employers, when employers look out at the labor pool, they have choices that are, you know, I can pay someone nothing. I can pay someone, you know, $5,000, $10,000 less than I would have 10 years ago and know that they'll take the job, A, because we have 7.5% unemployment,
right,
but B, because, you know, people's expectations are lower. Students are now not expecting to have a decent, good-paying job when they leave college. They're expecting an unpaid experience. As this really takes root, I think it's damaging the labor market.
Well, Mary, how do we improve? I mean, how do we keep the value of the experience here? Experience is important, but make it fair. Make it equitable.
Well, we only have so much control over what we can do, right? So we work within our own backyard, in our own community, in our own colleges and universities, and try to put together a program or a set of opportunities that really does make it possible for the student who is aspiring, who is motivated, who wants to work hard, who has a long-range goal they want to achieve, to help them to find the connections through alumni, connections through LinkedIn, connections in their communities, connections through faculty, to help give them that decided edge. I guess I'm not clear that our students who go on and graduate and get jobs, that they are competing with the interns whom we also send out. I mean, typically the internship level is at one level, and the entry-level job is a notch up at a level of more responsibility, you know, higher level functioning expected, more opportunity to grow in the position than in a three-month internship or a six-week internship or whatever. So I don't think it's really that competing, at least of the students whom we work with and the kinds of jobs that our students go out to.
Well, we're keeping an eye on that, what may be a creeping boundary there, a blurring boundary. Grateful for the insight of the two of you today. Mary Schilling, Executive Director of Career Development at the College of William and Mary, joining us from Williamsburg, Virginia. Mary, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
And Ross Eisenbray at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Ross, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a complicated picture out there. Good luck to all the new graduates and those still in college who are doing those internships. Hey, if you've got it, learn all you can. In a moment, The Hangover's Ed Helms tells new grads to embrace fear. This is On Point. Comedian and actor Ed Helms spoke last Saturday to the graduating class of Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. Known for his roles in the Hangover movies and The Office, he talked about his own struggles working as an assistant film editor in New York before pursuing his passion for stand-up comedy. His message to new grads, fear is good.
When you start doing stand-up, the first couple of times you go on stage, you kill. You're great at it, mainly because adrenaline is screaming through your brain and you're overly prepared. And then you bomb for the first time and it's brutal and everyone says, shake it off, you just need to keep at it. And this is where I think a lot of comedians just throw in the towel, because you can't shake it off. When you fail at the thing you love, it isn't on the outside of you like dirt or spilled mayonnaise. It's inside of you. It's in your molecules. And so I was really scared again, because I'd made some big life changes to accommodate this path. But I had learned to dig a little deeper, so I turned to my fear again and I said, all right, start talking, what's going on here? And my fear said, last night on stage you tanked and it was humiliating, so naturally I'm here to nag you and tell you don't ever go back on stage. You're not funny. And that led me to another more deliberate question. What will happen if I do go back up there? And fear squirmed a little, because fear despises truth. And he finally cracked and he said, well, you're still here, right? And even if you tank again, you'll still be here. And here's a little silver lining that you wouldn't know if you hadn't bothered to talk to me about this. The crowd reaction, albeit brutal, is really useful data. When they laughed, it was nice. But when they didn't, it was even more valuable. Why did that one joke work two nights ago and bomb tonight? And just as before, fear actually helped me out. I had recordings of those stand-up sets, and I was terrified to listen to them, but I did, and I heard the subtlest variations in my timing. I heard noise in the room that changed the energy. I heard details, and I made adjustments, and I got better, much better. And I never would have if I hadn't bombed in the first place, and if fear wasn't there to point out exactly where I needed to focus. Now, obviously, fear can't talk. And thank God, because I imagine it would have a horrifying voice like that guy from Saw. But I've anthropomorphized fear to make a point, which is that if you strike the right relationship with your fear, it can tell you a lot of really exciting things besides simply just what to be afraid of. If our ancestors didn't feel fear, the whole species probably would have been trampled by mammoths a long time ago. But if they never examined their fears, no delicious mammoth burgers. And so success lies in the tension between fear and discovery. That tension will always be there. But so long as your desire to explore is greater than your desire to not screw up, you're on the right track. A life oriented toward discovery is infinitely more rewarding than a life oriented towards not blowing it. So don't be afraid of fear, because it sharpens you, it challenges you, it makes you stronger. And when you run away from fear, you also run away from the opportunity to be your best possible self. And so today, in facing my own fear squarely and using it to interrogate myself, I realized something I probably should have known from the start. No slightly older, reasonably famous man or woman standing at a podium in an ill-fitting graduation gown can actually tell you what you need to know upon setting out on this day. Indeed, the truth about fear, as with the rest of life, is that you'll only really figure it out by living through it. So by God, get out there and live. Take your lumps, dole out a few lumps, and trust that you'll figure it out. Trust your instincts, trust your passions, trust your empathy, trust your love, and trust that even fear itself will want to stop, drop, and roll when confronted with the unstoppable passion and power of a Knox Prairie Fire. Thank you, and congratulations.
Comedian and actor Ed Helms speaking to graduates at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois on Saturday. For a video and transcript of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.